This interview with Barry Kellett of the Rutherford Appleton Laboratories near Oxford is part of the Jodcast. For the full show, go to www.jodcast.net.
Well, thank you very much for being with us today, and please tell us a little bit about the Smart One mission. What was it all about?
Okay, Smart One is ESA's first technology demonstration mission. It's designed to test technologies that ESA thinks it needs for the future missions. So basically, Smart One was a test of the Bepi Colombo mission to Mercury, which hopefully will go in the next 10 years.
Okay, so what was being tested?
The really exciting thing that was being tested was the new ion drive that we used. We got to the moon based on basically on sunlight.
Really?
Literally, yes. We converted electricity directly from the sun and used that to power the ion engine.
So this mission was testing a new way of getting probes from place to place.
This is true, yes, using just xenon and electricity.
In most previous missions, we have probes being propelled by standard chemical engines. You put chemicals together, they go bang, and you're away. What's different about the engine used in the Smart One mission?
Well, as you just said, it's like a firework. Typical chemical engine, bang, and it's gone. 5 minutes at maximum, and you've run out of energy. The Smart One engine, for example, fired its engine for more than 5,500 hours. That's 180 days, roughly 6 months. And we only used about 80 litres of fuel in that time.
To put that in perspective, in missions we've had in the past, say to the moon or to Mars, they use much more than 80 litres of anything to get where they're going.
That's right, yes. So we are very, very energy efficient. The problem with the ion drive is it provides a very, very tiny thrust. So if you can imagine holding a postcard on your fingertips, it's about 7 grams of thrust. That is the thrust. We're trying to move a 400-kilogram spacecraft with a postcard.
Right.
And it takes a long time. But let's say the engine has got the time it needs. So, for example, for Bepi Colombo mission, with a chemical engine, chemical rocket, it will take a certain time. With the ion engine added on, for adding this very tiny thrust, we cut the mission by 3 years. We get there 3 years early.
Right.
Everybody wants to save time and get there early. So,
right.
So even though, let's say, it sounds a ridiculous amount of thrust, it pays back in the mission lifetime.
But why does it take less time when you have so little thrust?
It's the classic story of the tortoise and the hare. You can't afford to power the chemical engine enough to take the shortcuts. Whereas with the slow, steady, you know, tortoise approach, you've got the time. You can use the very long arcs of the mission to just sneak ahead of where you would be otherwise, and it pays back in spades when you get there.
Slow and steady wins the race
every time. Yes.
How about that? Okay. So how does this thing actually work? How does this drive work?
It's called a Hall effect motor. So you've got to imagine a cylinder with magnets going across the cylinder. There's an electric field up and down the cylinder, and the electrons will whiz around like a racetrack.
Mm-hmm.
You then squirt xenon into this. The xenon will get ionized and it will get fired out the top of the cylinder to give power. It's one of these things where everything's perpendicular. So the electric field is perpendicular to the magnetic field, and both are perpendicular to the direction of the xenon ions.
It's essentially quite basic physics, isn't it?
The guy who discovered it obviously was named Hall.
Mm-hmm.
It's his effect. But he was studying just an ordinary electric cable. He was trying to work out what carried the charge. He wasn't doing rocket research. So he was just studying out what carried the charge in an electric wire. And we've used his effect. We've pinched his effect to make it into a rocket engine.
Why did it take so long to develop this technology if the physics is so simple?
It's a different approach. It requires a lot more components to make and a lot more control and precision. So it's taken a while, but say both the Russians and the Americans and the Europeans are developing this technology now, and it will become more common.
Do you see this as the future of space probe propulsion?
It's one of those things. If it's the right question, the ion drive is the right answer. So missions to Mercury, it's the right answer. For certain missions to Jupiter, it's the right answer. For missions to Mars, it probably isn't the right answer. Mars is reasonably straightforward to get to with ordinary engines, and so the ion drive probably wouldn't save you much there.
80 litres of xenon gets you to where? Where did it get Smart One?
So we used the Smart One ion drive engine to get us from low Earth orbit to the moon. The distance in normal units is about 250,000 miles. We travelled about 80 million miles. We actually went around the Earth 320 times. It took us 15 months. So there's two ways of saying this. We owed the world record for being the slowest people ever to go to the moon, which is not the good way of saying it. The good way of saying it is that we are the most efficient people to ever go to the moon. We went to the moon on 80 litres of fuel. Right. We're more proud of that than the tortoise record.
So we should point out that Smart 1 went from low Earth orbit to the moon with this engine. It didn't launch from the Earth's surface using it.
It's not a launch engine, but we took a piggyback on an Ariane. We got a fairly cheap launch with an Ariane as a piggyback passenger.
You work at the Rutherford Appleton Laboratories here in the UK. What was your part in the Smart 1 mission?
The engine is nothing at all to do with us.
Right.
Again, we're passengers on Smart 1. We took the chance to go with them.
What did you guys do?
So what we did, we provided an X-ray spectrometer called DKIX. Now, you might wonder, why would you take an X-ray instrument to the moon? Because obviously the moon is not an X-ray source. Mm-hmm. They're very hot. The reason we did it is for this very simple reason of trying to work out what the moon's made of.
Surely we know what the moon is made of. We sent men to the moon, they brought rocks back.
We only know, obviously, where... You know, the Americans played safe when they sent astronauts there. Apparently the astronauts wanted to come back, which seems to be a bit of a limitation for them.
It's quite selfish.
So I don't know what they're doing. Yes, and it turns out with sort of the modern knowledge that we've built up since the 60s, the areas of the moon that Apollo astronauts went to turns out to be remarkably not representative of the moon as a whole. It's like sending someone to the Sahara Desert and the Gobi Desert and somewhere else a desert. You'd think that all the Earth is made of desert.
So
we've got a slightly distorted view of what the moon's made of from the samples.
Oh,
the other thing is that what the Apollo astronauts took, they actually picked up rocks from the surface. And the one place we can guarantee that that rock didn't come from was where it was picked up from. It came from a crater somewhere else. Everything got flung everywhere. So it's a very interesting rock. You just have no idea where it came from. So what we're trying to do with DKIX and its sort of daughter, which will be launched on an Indian mission in 2 years' time, called KIX. We are trying to put these rocks back onto the moon where they came from, so we can then the information then becomes more relevant, more precise.
So you guys developed this spectrometer device, DKIX. Sounds like an acronym to me. What does DKIX mean?
It's got an X in it, which is X-ray. So it's the demonstration of a compact imaging X-ray spectrometer. Again, it's for Smart 1, it has to be new technology. We are the first people to fly a new kind of CCD device for X-ray astronomy. Our instrument is about a fifth or a sixth of the weight of the comparable Japanese instruments. So for once, we're actually better than the Japanese at this kind of thing. And it's about a tenth of the weight of the American one.
And presumably, this is important if your entire spacecraft is being propelled with a postcard's weight worth of thrust.
Given that the entire science payload on Smart 1 is 15 kilos, we wanted to fly three different instruments, weight is the only parameter that's interesting. So it has to be the smallest, the lightest, the least massive thing that you can fly. And so mass was always an issue with our instrument.
So what information did you obtain with a DKIX instrument?
So bizarrely, we looked at the sun, because we're using the sun as our light source. So the sun is shining on the moon in X-rays, and so we measure the signal from the sun with a very small sensor called XSM. We then look at the signal back from the moon with DKIX, and by comparing the input and the output signals, we can work out, with some fancy modelling, hopefully, we can work out what the moon's made of and get the abundances of the elements on the area of the moon that we're looking at.
So some of the X-ray wavelengths from the sun will be reflected off the moon's surface, some will be absorbed. Presumably you look at what wavelengths were absorbed by the moon's surface to determine its composition.
The reflected signal, we're not interested in because that's from the sun and we know what the sun looks like. But
right.
It's a signal that is also absorbed, you're quite right. And it's the absorbed signal that carries a fingerprint of the area of the moon that we're looking at. And we're looking at things like magnesium, aluminium, silicon and calcium. So if you ask a geologist what rocks are made of, they'll tell you it's these four elements. These are the main elements that rocks are made of. And by measuring the ratios of these elements, we hope to be able to work out, you know, the mineralogy of the moon as we see it.
Right. So you take the relative abundances of the elements to your friendly lunar geologists and say, so what does this indicate? What rocks are they?
They have an idea of the kind of minerals that are likely. And they all have all these wonderful names for them, pyroxene and olivine and all these kind of things, which mean nothing to me. But they can't tell precisely from what the information they have which particular member of the family it is. Mm. And so these family members of a particular group of minerals have particular abundance ratios. And so We have the family picture, but we don't know which member of the family it is that we're looking at. And by using the X-ray instrument, we hope to be able to provide that extra piece that it's this particular member of the family that we're looking at.
How will this help us? How will this increase our knowledge of the moon? I mean, surely we have a pretty good idea about the moon.
In simple terms, the answer is yes, but it's the devil's in the detail. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of very big questions that the answer is, we don't know. And I've been quite surprised myself, because I'm not really a lunar person, how little we know about the moon and how controversial some of the ideas still are. So there are these big questions. And I say, we have these samples on the Earth. We actually got from the Apollo guys. We also have samples of the moon from places like Antarctica, where meteorites on the moon have been collected and been identified as lunar. As I said before, we're trying to place these rocks back on the moon. Mm-hmm. They can be dated. Some of them are actually very young, relatively speaking. Some of them are only 1,000 million years old. That sounds a lot to us. But most of the moon is 4,500 million years old. Mm. And so these very young rocks, we want to know where they come from, because which bit of the moon is so young that it's these. And so it's this placing the rocks back into their context that will provide geologists and lunar geologists a lot of new information.
What do we not understand about the moon? I suppose the biggest question is, where did the moon come from?
When Apollo went to the moon, they knew what the question was. They had three models of where the moon came from, and within about a year of getting the results back, all three models were dead. So instead of being a great leap forward, as Armstrong told us, in fact it was a great leap backwards, and for about 5 years we had absolutely no idea where the moon came from. And then this new theory came out, this what's called the Mars Impact Theory came out. Right. This states that as the Earth was forming, the Earth was very young, very hot, a big ball of molten rocks. It got hit by an object about the size of Mars, or about a quarter of the size of the Earth. This kind of like the skin of a rice pudding, kind of knocked the skin off the Earth, flung it into space, flung itself, most of itself, into space as well, and then from that debris, you make the moon. Now, I say, doing the modelling for that is quite horrendous. And so I said, the devil's in the detail of how you do the modelling. And I said, there were certain questions about whether you go this way or that way, depending on certain circumstances. That's what we're trying to do, trying to help. I say, as I said before, we are looking at magnesium. Magnesium is a very light element. So if the entire moon melted after it was formed, magnesium will float.
Right.
Now, one of the other elements we can see occasionally, only occasionally, unfortunately, we can see iron. Now, iron is a very heavy element. It does the opposite. It will sink. Mm. So by looking at these two elements in various areas of the moon, we can work out, did the whole moon melt? Did the iron and magnesium separate out? Or is there another story? Now, at the moment, most people think the entire moon melted. It's called the magma ocean theory.
Right.
And hopefully, by looking at these two elements, we'll be able to work out whether or not that theory is true. And that will then rule out half the theories, and we can concentrate on the other half and just make progress slowly, step by step.
So the decision as to whether the moon was formed in scenario A or scenario B, is that finally balanced on the exact proportion of elements you will determine using Smart One?
That's the plan, yes.
That's very exciting. We look forward to the results. Now, we heard a lot about the demise of Smart One. It was very spectacular. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, again, as you probably tell, Smart One was a mission kind of on the cheap. So we only had 80 litres of fuel to get to the moon. When we got there, we had very little fuel left. So we got into the best orbit we could to do the science that we wanted to do. That orbit was not circular. It was a highly elliptical orbit. The downside of that is that it's highly unstable. Right. And there's things like the planet Jupiter and the Sun will pull on that orbit and make it decay. So we would have crashed after about a year if nothing had been done. So we used the very last dregs of the fuel tank by shaking it about and doing all kinds of fancy things. We got an extra bit of fuel out to give us an extra extension. Unfortunately, having done that once, we can't do it again. So if we had done nothing, we'd have crashed in the middle of August on the far side of the moon where nobody could see us. Mm-hmm. Now, we thought this was kind of dull and boring. If you're going to go out, you might as well go out with a bang. And so we used a little bit of the fuel that was used actually for steering the spacecraft, not for powering it. And by sort of doing fancy manoeuvres with these little jets, we were able to get the orbit to extend by an extra 2 weeks to the 3rd of September, which was a Sunday. And as everybody knows probably, that we crashed on a little mountain on the area of the moon. It was actually in the dark. Actually, it was being lit by Earthshine. But we we definitely hit the surface and made a little splash.
Now, the point of this wasn't just for fun, was it? There was some scientific basis for this, wasn't there?
So there are people who study impacts. And of course, we'd have to, you know, understand the nature of these impacts, because some of them might actually hit us, and that's the danger that people are worried about. So this is a highly controlled experiment. We know exactly how big Smart 1 was, how heavy it was. We know exactly what speed it was going. So all the parameters that you usually don't know for an impactor, you've now got. So hopefully the people who, if someone goes back and photographs the hole that we made, the people who do the modelling can then use that information to work out how well they can model the situation.
Right.
And hopefully learn from that for their own benefit as well.
Were people observing the impacts of Smart 1?
It was being observed by professional astronomers in Hawaii and in California, and by a whole bunch of lunatics in America. The amateur guys are keen on the moon. So hopefully a whole bunch of people saw this and will give us the answer back soon.
Now, presumably, Smart 1 would have sent up a big plume of stuff when it impacted.
The very early results that we've seen from Hawaii do show that we did send up a kind of little dust tail that went ahead of us in the direction we were travelling. Probably about 80 kilometres it travelled. We were hoping that it would travel upwards and come out of the shadow of the sun and into sunlight and be very bright. It doesn't appear to have done that. It appears to have gone straight forward and so I've been a little slightly faint. And so maybe not quite as useful as we were hoping for.
Oh, no, not to worry. Tell me a little bit more about the next mission you mentioned, Bepi Colombo.
That's the plan as I last understood, yes. So it's essentially the same question. Where did Mercury come from? Mercury is a weird planet. It's kind of an end member of the set. Compared to the Earth and Venus and Mars, it's nearly all core. It's got a very thin outer layer, mantle and crust. And so how did Mercury form? What's it made of? All the usual questions that we don't know the answers to. And so there will be certainly an X-ray instrument on Bepi Colombo, as well as cameras and other instruments to learn about Mercury. Mercury is probably, with Pluto, the least well-known and least understood planets in the solar system.
This is a ESA mission, a European Space Agency mission.
Yes.
Has it been funded?
It's part of what's called ESA's core programme, so it should go, certainly, but it's incredibly expensive to go to Mercury. And so there are still some doubts and question marks about exactly when it goes, and maybe even if it goes. It might still get cancelled, but it is still on schedule for like 2015 or 2014 launch.
Well, one mission at a time. You've got lots of data to look at from Smart 1, and we look forward to hearing the results. Thank you very much indeed for coming and talking to us today.
Thank you.